Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowring. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down at a Richmond cafe and have lunch with one of these artists. The conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we are talking to Jill Galarno. Welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tim.
Sure. Jill, you're currently down at VCU. And as our viewers can't really see, you're still a very young woman. How did this come about? How are you teaching and working at VCU?
I was invited down here through a fellowship called the Plant Zero Fellowship through VCU. And it's set aside each year just for one candidate who just received their MFA the year before.
Right.
So it will always be someone who's really young or who's just exiting a graduate program. And I applied for that, and with it comes a studio at Plant Zero and an opportunity to teach at VCU and an apartment.
And Plant Zero, for those of you who don't know out there, is not actually a television show. Plant Zero is over off of Hull Street between 3rd and 4th Street and is a collection of recently renovated studios, event space, and I guess there's a restaurant over there too now. And then there's also a separate exhibition space. Do you remember the name of what that building is called?
Solvent Space?
Yeah, the Solvent Space over there. So where were you in school?
I was at Cranbrook Academy of Art in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. How long were you there?
I was there for 2 years in the painting department there.
Wow. So what brought you to do this? How did this journey all come about? I mean, were you one of those kids who just sort of started drawing and painting when you were young? Were you always fascinated by it?
I was always fascinated by it. I was an only child. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I really remember getting into, I had lots of toys like Cabbage Patch Kids and all the whistles and bells, but I was really only interested in my box of crayons.
Really?
And I had these tapes that I would listen to. I don't remember the girl's name, but she was like a narrator. And you'd put in the cassette tape and she would take you on a journey, either to the past or to the future or to the circus. And she would kind of tell you what you were seeing. She would be like, there's the seals bouncing the balls. And then they would put like circus music on and you'd have time to draw.
Right.
And I would listen to the same tapes over and over and like re-illustrate the same events kind of every week.
Were your parents artists?
My mom is an interior designer, so she had all kinds of paint swatches and fabric swatches and carpet things.
Uh-huh.
She was always putting them together in different combinations.
But the work you were doing then as a child was illustrative, right?
I guess
sort of
so,
pretty much. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. And then as you moved through, I guess, high school, did the interest remain as someone who was doing representational work or illustrative work? Or how did that start to grow for you? Or are you still doing seals with balls on their...
No more seals with balls on their noses. One thing that I remember being something that changed my idea about the kind of art that I could make or the kind of art that would be relevant, I went on a trip with my mom to New York, and I saw a show at the Guggenheim Museum.
Right.
And it was kind of like a double show of two artists. It was Felix Gonzalez Torres and Ross Bleckner.
Really?
And both of them, I mean, I never could have formulated this the reason why I was attracted to it at the time. But when I look back on it, I realize that they're both artists who use abstraction. Like when you look at the paintings initially, mm-hmm. you think they're abstract. And then mm-hmm. both of them have narratives.
Really?
Or not necessarily narratives.
Talk about that. Because some of the people who listen to this radio show, I was going to call this radio show, I could have done that. You know, people walk into a museum and say, I could have done that. So you're talking about someone doing abstraction that's a narrative. What does that mean?
Well, some abstraction, you look at it, and it's just a comment on abstraction that came before it. Like the next step along the food chain, and it's just referring back to itself about abstraction. But mm-hmm. the work of Felix Gonzalez Torres and Ross Bleckner, it refers to people that they love in their life or events that happen in their life. And it can look really simple, like a Felix Gonzalez Torres piece might be like a string of Christmas lights that's hanging from the ceiling or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly an I can do that moment.
Right.
But both of their works are referencing... They're not just referencing other art or other abstraction. They're referencing love and emotions and
something in their
life.
Personal, deep in the or
both of them reference lovers and death and AIDS and
mm-hmm.
things like that.
I mean, do they take some of the things like sometimes some of the most stunning things are like you said the Christmas tree lights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I immediately when you said that. you know, for me, my background, obviously, if I was Jewish, I'd be staring at you going, okay, Christmas tree lights. You
right.
know, that reminds me of when everybody was running around and I was left alone with my Jewish family
right,
not doing Christmas.
Totally
my entirely different experience of it. But for me, there's a whole flavor, there's a whole tone, there's a whole taste, there's a whole emotional event, there's a whole visual memory just from that. So you're talking about that kind of narrative that brings about, that could necessarily bring about that kind of interaction between the viewer, or is this just, you think, just for the artist and then the viewer gets whatever the viewer gets?
No, I don't think it's just that the viewer gets whatever the viewer gets. I mean, in some cases, the viewer actually gets something. And in some of the Felix Gonzalez Torres pieces, the viewer can actually get a piece of candy and eat the piece of candy.
Oh, really?
So the idea is that, like, he's given you something or it's a lingering thing. And some things are more specific. Like, in some of the Ross Blechner paintings, there's an image of an urn. And mm-hmm. that's kind of a more familiar icon for remembrance or... will be hard to come up with something
right.
like Easter Bunny. I mean, it's more specific.
All right, so there you were at the Guggenheim. And you left the Guggenheim, and you went home, and you
yes.
put away your crayons and your seals and your balls. And what happened next?
Then I dropped out of Catholic school because
there
was no...
Are you a Catholic school dropout?
Kind of.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm afraid we're done here.
There was no opportunity to study both foreign languages and art at the same time.
And you had interest in both.
You had to choose one, and I had interest in both. So I switched to public school where I finished up my high school, and I took a bunch of art classes at community college.
Yeah.
So I only had to attend high school in the morning, and then I went to community college in the afternoon.
Where was this?
In Phoenix, Arizona.
Wow.
And I took two-dimensional design and painting and stuff at community college.
Wow, that's wonderful. And then the language?
I studied Spanish in high school.
Any connection between your interest in language and your interest in art, you think?
I think both.
Totally?
I think both language and art, I guess that there's two ways that they're related. They both have to do with bridging the gap between people who can't communicate. Like sometimes, like a drawing is understood the same in Russian as it is in English. I think it has to do with bridging communication gaps.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of my work... has to do with language. Like, I'll use words, I highlight words when I'm reading and phrases in books, and then
right.
I string those together to make different titles, or I respond to words from the dictionary. And one thing I really like about language is the different phrasings and idioms and words that don't exist in English.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you were talking about bridging the gap and communicating in your work. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think one kind of gap that my work tries to bridge is the difference in my experiential perception and someone else's and
uh-huh.
yours or
right.
and the viewers or my mother's or
right.
whoever.
Right, right.
And all the ways that you store knowledge or store ideas in your head, they're not just conceptual, they're experientially based. They're from things that you've experienced in life, and everyone has experienced things differently.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to make two things happen at once, or simultaneous overlapping things, or I'll ask people how they experience something and try to portray how they experienced and how I experienced it in the same
right.
piece.
So you think we're all having different experiences of the same thing called life?
Yeah.
Really?
Definitely. Or I think that even if you and I have the same experience, we
uh-huh.
go to the same party or we see the same band play,
right.
I think that the way that you're going to interpret it is completely different than how I'm going to interpret it.
And so part of your journey is to share your experience?
I don't think it's to share my own experience as much as it is to kind of reconcile the gap between why my experience doesn't line up with other people's.
Give me an example. Can you? I don't know. That might not be a fair question. Can you give me an example? I mean, obviously,
one example that I think is really simple that everyone can kind of relate to is how we have false memories. How I remember really clearly from when I was little that I was standing in my backyard with my my grandma, and we were watching my dog run around, and I ran into her arm, and she was smoking a cigarette, and my arm got burnt. And
mm-hmm.
I remember it very clearly, but everyone in my family tells me it doesn't happen. I don't have a scar, and my grandma never smoked.
Wow.
So, and I think everyone has these kind of like really disjunctive things, or in a relationship, sometimes you're talking about
yeah.
when we first met, and there'll
right.
be two completely different versions of the story.
Right. So how do you express that in your work? I remember we only have a half an hour.
One way that I try to express that in my work is to develop structures to put more than one experience in one moment. And one thing that I use as a structure is a horizon line. So I'll have horizon lines of different moments where they're...
When you say horizon line, what do you mean? I'm sorry to pick you apart.
Horizon line is like when you stare...
Off into the distance. So you're talking about the typical horizon line that somebody learns in perspective drawing.
Exactly.
Kind of that thing.
So in,
okay.
In,
or when you're flying in an airplane, there's that thing called the horizon line. Try to stay level with.
Right.
Okay. Right.
So I'll use horizon lines in different wall drawings. I'll start a drawing by putting four lines on the wall. There'll be horizon lines. Then I'll build moments off those horizon lines, but they'll be shifting. So all of the moments are lining up on a zigzagging line. So they're all kind of happening at once.
You say wall. Do you all your work as installations?
Right now I'm considering that all of my finished work is an installation. I do complete a lot of the drawings that will go into the installation beforehand. Like I'll amass a big pile of drawings in my studio. And then in the finished piece, they'll be knit together, painted together, pieced together into some kind of installation on the wall.
Okay. So how do you deal with all the different... I mean, there must be a tremendous amount of different visual information going on there. But somehow it all has to work together, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. So that must be really very, very challenging.
It involves a lot of editing.
A lot of editing, yeah.
It involves a lot of editing. And I think of the drawings as kind of framed moments.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you put something in a rectangle or a square, it's almost like a snapshotted moment.
Right.
And... then when it gets fed back into the drawing, the wall drawing, then the snapshot moment it's kind of like a memory moment in the bigger scene.
Well, do me a favor, because I think there are artists listening who are going, this is really interesting, and there are other people listening going, I have no idea what is this woman talking about. Walk me through, can you, maybe you can't, because a lot of people say, you know, look, Tim, if I could talk about it, I'd be a writer, for God's sake, you know? But walk me through a piece that you've done recently. I mean, you did a piece at Bev Reynolds Gallery. Mm-hmm. Again, we're talking to Jill Galarno, who is currently, I guess you're finishing up a year at VCU, and you were chosen as a fellow, although you're obviously not a fellow. It's a fellowship program, correct?
Yes, it is. I'm just finishing up my one year here.
Your one year here. And I guess you were teaching and able to make art and had a studio.
Yes.
But anyway, what we were just talking about is your work and the fact that your work is an attempt to conceptualize installations that go on walls that have that are abstract in many ways, but also have a certain sort of narrative and capture certain sort of experiences that you have in your life that you perceive in a certain way, someone else may perceive in another way, but is your challenge is that communication of, like you said, even though we might have the same experience, we might have a very different perceptual experience of it, and you're sort of playing with and toying with that. And when I use the word play, and I've said this before in this show, I'm talking about play in the most sophisticated sense, which, you know, to most Americans is like, well, I don't play around. I go to work. You know, I work really hard. And I don't play around.
I play around.
Yeah. But you know, but artists do play around. And so do scientists play around. And so do philosophers play around. And so do a lot of people who do a lot of very, very heavy conceptual thinking play, because that's how you get there. Mm-hmm. You don't get there by following the rules.
No.
You get there by playing. So talk a little bit about playing and talk about your narrative in your work. What do you... Can you walk us through a piece of yours? Is that possible to
do? Sure. I can talk a little bit about the installation I just did at Reynolds Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
For this piece, I've used as a jumping off point one drawing that I had made about a year ago that looks like a honeycomb pattern. And it's like a hexagonal grid. Mm-hmm. And it actually came from a drawing of wooden floorboards fit together like on a wood floor.
Right.
And when I first came here to Richmond, I silkscreened that pattern on a bunch of paper. And then I made many separate drawings using that grid as the background. So I did, the first drawing was the most straightforward interpretation of that, where I made a drawing of the floor with all of the dust bunnies and kitty litter and broken glass and bottle caps and things that you'd find on a dirty floor. And that was kind
but
of
what,
the starting
do you know,
point.
I mean, I don't want to get too far afield, but what drove you to do this? Because again, if you're listening to the outside, right? This is totally engaged. You're totally engaged in this process. And someone's thinking, no, wait a minute. She just silkscreened a whole bunch of floors. And now she's drawing the floor on the floor. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What engages you about that? Why?
Well, the idea of the dirty floor engages me because it's what's left afterwards. It has to do with memory and kind of what you don't usually look at. But the reason that I started with the grid pattern was because it was a really rigid, abstract grid that I could use to connect things. And I knew that,
It could so be the matrix. Served two spirits. So this was the canvas.
This was the canvas
you were starting on.
I knew that if the grid got smaller, things could get farther away.
Right.
If it got bigger, it could be huge pieces of wood. Mm-hmm. And so then the initial drawing, the grid was just the floor. And then I started to cut and collage the grid and use it as walls and as drawers. And then I just started to use it as an abstract grid that held things together. And I painted the grid over a woman jumping into a pool. And she was outdoors, but she was kind of indoors because she still had the grid that was the house was made of on her. So it's
what was that about?
It was about being in two places at once. It was about being indoors and outdoors. And then after I made that piece and I had painted the grid on her, one way that I find titles is I just write down scraps of writing that I've picked up from books. And I just sat with a whole list of titles, and I keep reading them out and looking at the piece until I find one that just kind of clicks with it. And the woman looks...
So that's where the language piece comes in.
Yeah.
So a title is more than a title for you.
Yeah.
A title is a part of the piece.
It's definitely part of the piece.
Ah, okay. All right. That's interesting. So what did you come up with?
So the title that resonated with that piece for me was called You Think Like a Prisoner.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I liked that because she looks very free. She's in her swimsuit. She's maybe a young adolescent, and she's jumping off a rope into the water.
Right.
And it looked like she was a prisoner because she had the bars of the grid painted over her.
Right.
And it seemed like a moment that someone would fantasize about if they were a prisoner, like going swimming in a lake or...
Oh, so you think like a prisoner. See, when I heard that, I thought your thinking is limited. Your thinking is... bourgeois, predefined, socially confined, and you're going in the exact opposite. Are you?
See, we have opposite interpretations.
We had opposite, right. Wow, that's really amazing. I thought everybody thought what I thought. This is a real moment for me. Excuse me. I'm going to lose it here. Okay. So you've got these moments. These moments in time, these moments in experience, these moments in perceptual experience and emotion and thought and consciousness and, I guess, in a sense, you know, subconscious in a way. And you're stringing all these things together, or are they their own little vignettes that just all happen to be in the same place together? You can say I don't know, by the way.
I'm thinking about it. I definitely think of them as their own little vignettes because, like, for instance, that one wall drawing has its own title.
What's the title?
Will You Think Like a Prisoner?
Oh, it is.
Okay.
So the whole piece has one title.
Well, the whole piece, the whole installation as you walk around it is titled Only the Past Existed Soon Enough.
Only the what?
Only the Past Existed Soon Enough. But
Only the Past Existed
within
soon
that,
enough.
There's many little titles.
Mm-hmm.
So... I do think of them
and
as...
And these are actually written out.
They're typed out, and there's little tiny numbers on the wall, and you can follow them around the room. But do they do that? I don't know. I don't have a hidden video camera to spy on them when I'm not there.
I mean, would they even know to do that? How would they know to do that?
I think anyone familiar with Reynolds Gallery knows about the little numbers on the wall, so maybe if they're like a return visitor, they would know that she keeps sheets out with titles, but I'm not sure that...
Okay, so you're talking about the numbers on the walls that they put next to a painting.
Yes.
Individual, but yours are through the narrative.
Mine are throughout the narrative, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Okay. See, I thought it was just peculiar to what you were doing.
No.
But you're doing it in exactly the same way that they normally do it with. So you pick up that sheet of paper, it has the name of the painting on it.
Yep.
But it sounds like the names of your paintings are much more a part of the piece than just, no?
I don't know. I always read other artists' titles, and I get really disappointed when things are titled like Untitled or Orange Series Number 6.
Number six, I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Mine are more...
But you have more of a fascination with language, so...
Yes, in that way, mine are definitely part of the piece.
All right.
And sometimes I use them and string them together. Mm-hmm. Like if one drawing is titled Soon Enough and one drawing is titled like Chimichanga's Under Red Sauce, then maybe the next drawing that combined those two ideas would be Soon Enough I Will Eat Red Chimichangas.
So what was the other title you just said a minute ago that didn't make any sense to me initially?
only the past existed soon enough.
Does that mean anything to you?
I think it was from a character in a book who said something about only the past existed when he was trying to remember something. It has to do with nesting the different tenses.
Uh-huh.
Like, only the past existed.
Right.
It's existing in the past sense, and then right. soon enough is something that's going to happen in the future.
Right. I mean, I like the concept.
All of those...
I mean, I think I get it, but yeah. I mean, it's kind of a wonderful play on words. That's what it really is.
A lot of people just told me it didn't make sense.
Really?
Yeah. Huh.
Well, tell them that that's their perception. And maybe someday they'll be able to understand it like we do. But if not, that's okay. All right. So where do you go from here? We're talking with Jill Galarno. And by the way, in case you're interested, it is a French name, which is the reason that I can't pronounce it. Although you'll never hear that because I've just edited out three or four absolutely off the wall misrepresentations of the name. So, Janice, how long have you been? How long have you been? All right. So VCU, when you do an installation on a wall, I've always kind of wondered about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's done. I mean, you can't just peel that thing off and take it home,
Mm-mm.
right?
Mm-mm.
All right. The only thing I can think of that comes close to that is I studied Buddhism for a couple of years, and I got an opportunity to meet some Buddhist monks who were traveling through Washington, D.C., and they did a sand painting.
Mm-hmm.
And I also got a chance to meet some here at Virginia Museum who did a sand painting. Ah, it took them like a week and a half, 2 weeks. You know, I mean, you know, colored sand, right? I mean, it takes forever. And this incredibly complex, beautiful thing. And then they take it down. I think they took it down to the James River and dumped it into the James River, maybe, or something. But is there anything similar to that around the lack of – their whole thing is around their lack of permanency.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's impermanent. Everything you're attached to is keeps you more bounded to this world, keeps you more attached to this world. And this world is ultimately painful because everything you're attached to you ultimately lose because you ultimately die. Therefore – it's pretty much the whole thing's absurd. I'm not saying your life as an artist is absurd. I'm not. That's not where I'm going with this. I guess we're over. Jill, come back, Jill. The thing about permanency, I mean, so many artists, you know, I mean, they keep every single thing they've ever made. And yet you've got things that are going on walls. And I'm assuming when you go rip them off the walls, they're not just peeling off nicely like plastic, are they?
Well, everything's put up with a pin.
It is.
Just a little straight pin.
Oh, okay. So you can save them.
Some of the really tiny pieces I have to glue to the wall, but for the most part, everything is put up with a pin.
Ah,
so I save them and they get little holes in them. But all of your experiences are restructured through your memory and you can kind of never piece things back together.
Interesting. Huh. So where do you go from here? Your year is over. Yes. And our interview is getting close to being over.
Okay.
What happens now?
I'm moving back to New York, which mm-hmm. is where I lived before I started graduate school.
Right.
And
where are you? Are you in the city? In Brooklyn?
I'm going to move back to Brooklyn, which is where I was living
mm-hmm. right.
Before. But I'm going to keep looking for opportunities to find new spaces to install in and new spaces to respond
mm-hmm.
to.
Right. The same struggle every single artist on the face of the planet
yep.
faces, which we haven't talked about much at all, but, you know, the courage it takes to do something like this as opposed to, well, I mean, I don't know if you really have a choice, but I do think it does take courage to go on a journey that's a unique journey, that is an expression of yourself, that is putting that expression out into the public, that is asking people for feedback and interest in it, that allows you to continue to grow, allows you to continue to explore, to perceive life and experience life on an interior way, interior level, so much differently than, you know, than so many others whose lives I think are, you know, none of us want to admit it, but, you know, how much time do we spend at a job? You know, how much time do we spend sitting in front of a television set? And I'm not saying artists don't watch television. They do, for God's sake. But it just seems to me that internal journey is almost an added perception or an added dimension of life. Do you see it that way at all? Or do you just see it as your life?
You make it sound really glamorous. I still watch a lot of TV.
Yeah, I know. So it's really been a completely depressing and terrible thing for you, making art.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Well, young artists coming up, what would you say to them? Keep listening to tapes and doing seals and balls, and God knows where you'll end up.
Yeah.
And keep on that journey. Does it feel like a journey to you?
It doesn't feel like a journey anymore than, I mean, I can only live my own life. I can't get in someone else's, but it doesn't seem like a journey any more than the lives of my friends who have chosen other careers or other paths are on a journey as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. That is interesting. Well, thank you. It's hard to believe, but we are out of time.
Thank you.
So thank you for coming. Thank you for talking. I know we wandered a little bit there, but I think there were some very, very interesting things in there about perception and about how you see things and how you capture moments and look at those and cherish those as you move through your life. Thank you, folks, for tuning into Zero Hour. I hope you've enjoyed our lunch together. We look forward to seeing you on the radio next Friday at 12:30. This is Tim Bowring. You're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us, and I'm going to try it one more time. Jill Galerno?
Galerno.
Gosh. It's too bad we can't do like a rifle shot sound here, you know, something. And that's it, folks. We're out of here.